All right. Hello, everyone. There's an Alabama game on tonight, I can see. Yeah. All right. You want me to put my phone on live updates, just sort of every now and then, let you know? Anxiety. Oh, you know, great segue. If I told you guys that I knew Alabama was going to win tonight and that they were going to make an unbelievable run, win the SEC, and make it to the Final Four, and you knew that I was telling you the truth, would it bug you if they lost a game between now and the end of the season?
No.
No, it wouldn't bother you at all, would you? Because you know how the story ends. As a Christian, we know how the story ends. But that doesn't mean that between today and the end of time that we're not going to have some setbacks and some struggles and things that don't go my way. But man, we live like we don't know how this thing ends. And, you know, we're going to talk about suffering tonight, so kind of a nice segue there. Okay, we've been talking about what anxiety is, what forms it takes, what causes it, what to do about it. And then we've been talking about depression. What forms it takes, what causes it. Tonight we're going to talk about what to do about it. And then we're going to delve into the topic of suffering in more detail. So tonight's about depression and suffering. This is going to be a blast, right? Just with you. Awesome. Yeah, just the two things you wanted to talk about, depression and suffering. Okay. I want to give you a brief recap, and I included it on your handout just because we were kind of in the middle of what causes depression. Overall, I had six things. We're going to do number five and six tonight, which we did not cover last week. So the first four that we did cover, I said that that depression is the result of a sin-broken humanity. Okay, that's kind of the global answer, and that's the truth. Without sin, there wouldn't be depression. There wouldn't be cancer, COVID, any of that stuff. But then we said that on an individual basis, that depression can be caused by personal sin, okay? So things like guilt and shame from disobedience, those are just quick examples of where depression, you know, my personal sin can lead to guilt and shame that can lead to depression. But I don't want you to think of depression as a direct punishment for your personal sin. Jesus answered that question in the verse we were talking about last week. I think it was John 9, with a guy who's born blind from birth. You can go listen to the tape if you, I don't have that verse in front of me. Okay, and then the second thing we said causes depression is medical and biological factors. Things like physical illness, your general health or lack of sleep, things like that. Genetic patterns. We talked about spiritual factors that cause depression. And I was pointing out, and I rewrote this, for the visually impaired like me, it's a little bigger. We talked about spiritual factors, whether it's anxiety or depression, when we either fear that these things are true, abandonment, insufficiency, uncertainty, and pain and suffering, endless pain and suffering. If I fear these are true, and I doubt that God is omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient, and good, then anxiety is right there at the door. And then we said that depression is when it goes a little step further and we begin to believe that these things are true about ourselves, and we have believed that God is not these things, these attributes. So those are kind of spiritual factors. When we forget who God is, okay? And then we get into the fourth thing we talked about was situational and circumstantial problems that can cause depression. Things like loss and stress and pain and suffering. And then, here we get into the new stuff. Cognitive factors that can cause depression. Now, again, we're going to talk about, this is the views and the perceptions, all right? So, like we discussed 2 weeks ago, anxiety is mostly a cognitive problem. It's based on your views, the cracks and smudges on your glasses. If you believe that white apple pens are dangerous, then every time I pull this thing out, you're going to have a fight-flight response, remember? But that would be a wrong perception. Now the reason that's important is because we said that anxiety is the number one cause of depression. Number one. All right, but that's a cognitive thing. Okay, and so then we get into, we talked about unrealistic, unmet expectations. You remember the Berlin study, where the life satisfaction study of the people in Berlin. They were more satisfied with life than Americans today because of their expectations and their reality. They expected they might be dead in the morning, or their neighbors might be, but the reality was they woke up and some guy was making them fill out a survey. Well, if your reality exceeds your expectations, then you're going to be pretty satisfied, right? And then something, sort of a new twist on cognitive factors. I'm going to call this negative thinking, all right? That can cause depression. When I believe certain lies about myself, let's say that I believe that I'm a failure or that I'm unlovable, or if I believe that other people hate me, or if I believe that God is not these things, or if I believe something about the future, that maybe the future is hopeless for me, or what if I believe that the world was threatening and dangerous? You can see that that can lead to depression, certainly anxiety, but definitely depression, if I believe that no one would ever love me and that I'm a complete failure. I want to share a quick story about some research they did with dogs, and this kind of ticks me off because I like dogs, and I don't really think you can do this anymore. but they took these dogs, and they put them in a little wire cage, and they wired that thing with electricity, okay? And there was a little divider in the middle so that the dog could kind of hop back and forth between the two sides. And so I'm making psychologists sound like bad people. Yeah. Anyway, the psychologist was sitting back. I'm sure it was an intern, was sitting back and would punch the button, and it would sort of electrify this one side, and the dog would be like, oh, and he would jump over here, and you know, where he was safe. And then the intern would turn that side off and turn this side on, and the dog would go, and he'd jump over here. And so they made a note, dogs don't like electricity. Brilliant. Okay, so then they turned on both sides, since the dog kind of hopped back and forth trying to figure out where it was safe and couldn't get away from it. Do you know what he did? No, it wasn't just one dog. They did this to lots of dogs, I guess. They do it to mice and dogs. And I think I'm okay with it. They do it with mice for some reason. I don't know. No, I'm really not there either. Okay, the dog eventually just laid down and took it. Oh. I know. Thank you. Oh. And eventually, you know, and then they're like, oh, turn it off. But the interesting thing about that is that, you know what happened to the dog? He didn't die, but it affected the dog's appetite, his energy level, his ability to learn new tricks. His tail wasn't wagging like it used to. He was showing signs of depression. So they came up with this term called learned helplessness, okay? Where if you're jumping around, you can't seem to make your situation any better, eventually you just think, well, nothing I do is going to make an impact here. And you just lay down and take it. So it's a sense of being trapped and unable to remedy an intolerable situation. That's terrible, isn't it? If you were stuck in a situation like that. I mean, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands of who can relate. I hope you've never been trapped in an electric box. But if you believe that nothing you do will make a difference, then that belief of hopelessness can cause depression. Okay, and I said I was going to keep trying to point out to you, you know, where these things go. That would be an example of pain and suffering and insufficiency. You know, when you're powerless to make change and it's going to, you know, be endless and pointless. Okay. Now we get to emotional factors, the last thing that can cause depression. This would be another way of saying this would be feelings, all right? Now, one thing we've been talking about is that feelings are like the end of they're the caboose on the train. So your feelings are a result of the things happening to you in life and what your view may be. Okay, so situations and your brain or your cognitive, and then you're going to feel something. So by the time someone gets to the emotions of anger, guilt and shame, unforgiveness, those are really a result of some cognitive and spiritual things, but certainly anger, if left undealt with, can lead to depression. there's a something. My parents have a trash compactor, and I don't know who all uses those anymore. Maybe lots of people. But it's kind of an interesting idea, but it's a bad idea too. They fill it up with stuff, and then they push a button and squish it down, put more stuff, squish it down, put more stuff. You can do that for about 4 or 5 days until you finally have to take it out. Great idea. The problem is, what about that hamburger and ice cream you put down there a week ago? By the time you are ready to dump it out, it's rotten, okay? And you better not spill it. You're going to have a major mess. But emotionally, a lot of times we're like a trash compactor. You know, we stuff our anger in and we don't deal with it. And I'm probably going to talk about anger next week in more detail, so I don't want to dive into it too much tonight. But things like anger and guilt and shame and unforgiveness, man, if you stuff that inside and just kind of trash compact it, grind it down, you don't get away with that for free. It's going to eventually get you, okay? And it can cause depression. Real quick, guilt and shame, you know, a lot of times we say those together, but those are really different things. I want you to think of guilt as when you feel bad about something that you've done, okay? So if you make a mistake or you fail at something, usually guilt would be the word we would use there. Shame is feeling bad about who you are, okay? So guilt is feeling bad about what you've done. Shame is feeling bad about who you are. Instead of making a mistake, you are a mistake. Instead of failing at something, you are a failure. One of my coaches, this was like junior high, okay, so don't worry, I did not play college or professional. But one of my early coaches said to me, Al, failure is a description of an event, not a person. I've always remembered that. You can probably assume why he was telling that to me. Unforgiveness and resentment. Have y'all ever heard that harboring unforgiveness is like drinking poison and waiting for the one who offended you to die? You ever heard that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another one that I think is interesting. Resentment really only punishes you. The other person has no idea, unless you're leaving them nasty notes on their car or something. So all these emotional factors, anger, guilt, shame, unforgiveness, if they're left over, it just becomes a health hazard for you. And most of the time it's depression. Okay, what do we do about depression? What can we do about it? Well, I got like 8 things. Yeah, we're going to get to it. Okay, the first thing is get a thorough medical exam. So when someone walks into my office and they say, Al, I'm depressed, one of the first things I want to know from them is, when's the last time you saw a medical doctor? Because there, as we talked about last week, there are a ton of things that can cause depression, and I don't want to waste their time and money talking to them about, loss in their life, and then they go, Al, you know, I've been trying to tell you, I have no loss in my life, or I'm really not angry about anything, or, I have a great life, but I just can't seem to, I can't eat, have no energy, can't concentrate, I'm sad all the time, no motivation, and then I'm thinking, well, maybe they have a medical problem. So it's a pretty simple thing. Go get a medical evaluation. Get some blood drawn. Let's see what happens. See what you got. Because sometimes depression is straight up medical. Okay? Number 2, be healthy. This is how we overcome depression. Let's talk about being proactive for a minute. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Your grandma probably said that to you when you were growing up. I'm going to tell you what it means. It's better to spend a little bit of time preventing stuff than spend a lot of money and time with a major problem. Okay, so we want to try to be proactive. Believe it or not, the healthier you are, the less likely it is that you will suffer from depression. there's something I call the 5 big rocks. And that sounds kind of weird, but I was at this class one time years ago, and the professor pulls out this big jar, and he has these big rocks lined up on the table there, and then a little stack of little rocks, and then some sand and some water. And some people are nodding their head. You know, you've probably seen this before too. And the assignment is get all this stuff in the jar. Okay. But how you go about that determines whether you're going to get it in the jar or not. If you put the water in first and the sand, by the time you get somewhere middle, you know, to the medium-sized rocks, I mean, that thing's overflowing. Only way to do it is put the big rocks in first. And then you sprinkle the little rocks, and they sort of settle on in. And then the sand settles in even more. Then by the time you get to the water, it just goes right on top. Everybody's happy. And you make a nail in the thing there. So in life, to me, there are some really big things that we got to get done first. If you want to be healthy, and these the five big rocks, from my point of view, would be mental, physical, spiritual, social, and vocational. And basically, I'm putting out there that if you can stay balanced and healthy in all of these areas, then you can avoid things like depression for the most part. You can certainly stack the odds against it. Let's talk about some of these for a second. What do I mean by a mental big rock? Well, exercising your brain. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I'm very curious how many of you guys have had 10 minutes of silence and solitude in the last 6 months? Anyway, we're not going to ask for a show of hands. Probably not many of you. Alone time, relaxation, think time, journaling, music, reading. These are all things that are really, really good for your mind, for your brain, your mental health, okay? We don't do enough of that because of this. But there's an app on here that tells you you're supposed to breathe and be quiet. What do you do when that happens? You just swipe left and get rid of that thing. Okay. Mentally, oh my goodness, we got to be mentally healthy. Physically, next thing, sleep, diet, exercise. I think we talked about it a few weeks ago. For everyone in this room, probably 8.5 hours. Cisco 7.5 to 8.5 is probably healthy. Most people don't get anywhere near that much. Most of us eat way too much fast food, not enough healthy stuff. Most of us don't exercise regularly or get outside. I'm going to tell you a little bit about a sleep study, just because I can't resist. I love this study. They took these four groups of people. These stuff like this wants, it makes you want to be a psychologist, right? We do all the weird stuff, all the fun studies. Yeah. Just talk to me later. Okay. So they divided these people into four groups. It was a sleep study. So the first group was 0 hours of sleep, then 2 hours, two, four, six, eight, okay? And they gave everyone two tests before they started. The first test was just a test of how do you feel? Do you feel good? Do you feel tired? Do you feel grumpy? The next test was more of a cognitive test, like cognitive speed, manipulate these blocks or say these numbers backwards. And so everyone scored the same, because they'd been sleeping at home for the study. Okay, then the study began, and the two-hour people, four-hour people, and they would wake these people up and make them take the test. About a couple days into it, they let the two-hour people go home because their subjective measure of how good do you feel was like going bad, and their cognitive ability was just tanking big time within a couple days. The four-hour people hung in there for a few more days, and then they sent them home. And so then 2 weeks go by. I think they finally stopped it at 2 weeks, but by the second week, the 6 and 8 hour people were hanging tough. They were both saying, we feel pretty good. The subjective test was, hey, I feel good. But the 6 hour people, before 2 weeks was up, the people with 6 hours of sleep, and again, I'm not going to ask you, their cognitive scores were going down. Ugh. And they got to the conclusion that if you maintain sleep deprivation, which is what they called the six-hour group, certainly the five-hour groups, that if you maintain that for 2 weeks, if that's what you think, well, I only need 4 or 5 hours of sleep, well, your family may think you're a hero, but you're cognitively impaired. Ooh. How many of us are out doing dangerous jobs with 4.5 hours sleep? Please don't do that, because I have to drive on the road with you, and I'd rather you get more sleep. Okay, I'll now hop off that soapbox. Spiritual, let's talk about that for a minute. Time alone with God, man, If you said that I had one more thing to say to you before I die, that would be the one thing I would say to you, that it's a non-negotiable for your health, physically, spiritually, everything, that you spend consistent time alone with God. It's priceless. It's right there. God wants to meet with you. I don't have time to even say it any clearer than that. Well, I do. I just did. Okay. Church, ministry outreach, doing ministry to the poor and needy. All these are, I'm going to put all those under the spiritual category, okay? Are you healthy spiritually? Do you have a small group? I mean, Jeremy can talk to you about that. And then let's get into the social big rock. Y'all all like this one probably. Family and friends, investing in other people, laughing. If you're out of balance there, believe it or not, if you do too much of it or too little of it, it can throw you off. And then the last thing is vocationally, working at something. There may be some in this room who are independently wealthy, and that's fantastic, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be working at something. Be intentional and purposeful. Do something that benefits the community. And then on the other side of that coin, have some margins in your life where you unplug and you're not working all the time. Some of us were raised with the idea that that's what we do if we love people. We work all the time and we pay for all the stuff. But that leads to divorce in crazy numbers, okay? So the main thing I want to say about all these five big rocks, it's about balance, okay? It's so easy to get out of balance, either overemphasizing or underemphasizing one of these biggies. And it can lead to stress and burnout and depression, all right? Number three, reach out to others. Now, this one is super hard, you know, because I'm talking about if you're depressed, it's important to reach out to other people to get rid of your depression. Okay, that's really super hard. I totally understand. You know, letting your friends and family and church help you in reaching out is very, very difficult. That's the last thing that you feel like doing. Because depression lies to you and says that only weak, unspiritual people get depressed. So you got to keep that a secret. And so you're up against a very formidable enemy there. That lie can be deadly, literally. Okay, so please, if you're depressed, find somebody to tell. Ask those people who are close to you to keep track of you, to touch base with you, stay involved. You know, as a church, we do a great job of ministering to people with physical illnesses. I mean, who all's been on the meals list when somebody's having a baby or they break their leg or they get COVID or something like that? Of course, when that's the case, we set it on the front porch and we walk away. But we don't do a very good job as a church of ministering to people who are depressed. And that's because we really don't know that much. I mean, they just aren't showing up to stuff and we don't know why, and we don't want to offend anyone and ask, hey, where's Jim? I hadn't seen him in a while. As a Sunday school class or as a small group, if you hadn't seen somebody in a while, reach out, please, because it's super hard for depressed people to reach out for themselves. When you're depressed, if you minister to other people, it actually will help you. Because depression tends to make us focus only on ourselves, but watch the magic when you go to a soup kitchen or help homeless people or something like that. You get in your car and you got a smile on your face, even if you're depressed. It feels so good to have a moment where we get outside of ourselves and help someone else who's got other problems that we don't have. So believe it or not, depressed people can help depressed people. Have you ever heard the statement, misery loves company? That's not actually true. And everything I say is research-based, okay? So I'm always right. No kidding. The statement should be, misery loves miserable company. Because if someone's miserable and Mr. Happy comes walking in the room, they don't, that's like, oh my gosh, do I really have to listen to that guy again? People who are miserable are more comfortable with miserable people, and they actually can help each other. That's true. So if you're depressed, don't think that you can't help other people. Group therapy is extremely effective. Okay, so that's reaching out to others. Next thing, reach out to God. Now, this is still stuff we can do about depression. reach out to God. Al, what do you mean by that? Don't ever stop crying out to the Lord in prayer, okay? It's okay to vent to God. There's so many examples in the Bible of people screaming out to God, and not once that I have found does God ever say, hey, you need to, you know, quiet down over there. God never disciplines the person who was crying out to him in pain. There's an interesting passage in Luke 18, 1-8, for those who want to read that later. It's a parable of the persistent widow and the judge. And I'm not going to go into that in great detail, but I want to read you what Jesus said. He says, he's starting this parable, and he says, he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. Now, the parable is about this widow that keeps going to the judge, and he doesn't want to do what she needs, and she keeps bugging him until finally he relents. Then there's a passage in Daniel 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, one of my favorite stories in the Bible, where the emperor says, "If I'm going to build this thing, and when the music plays, you bow down to the idol, and if you don't, I'm going to throw you in the furnace." Well, these three guys, they said, hey, we're not going to do that. We're not going to worship you. We're going to worship the living God, and we know that you may throw us into the fire, but our God can save us. Now, I love this part. He says, they say, but even if he doesn't, we're still going to worship him. We're not going to worship you. Ooh, that's awesome. And what great faith. Even if he does not rescue us, we're not going to worship you. David, King David in the Psalms, he says repeatedly things like, he talks to his heart. He says, listen to me, heart. When's the last time we talked to our heart? I mean, most of the time I'm listening to what my heart is saying to me, and it's usually not good. Talk to your heart. Pray your tears, as David would say. The main idea of prayer is thy will be done. We need to pray that the Lord would grant us the strength to persevere through pain and suffering. Don't ever stop reaching out to God. Number five, remember who God is. We've spent a lot of time talking about this already. Whether it's anxiety or depression, remembering who God is probably the most important thing. Because it helps you battle about the four things that we tend to fear and believe. When you can remember who God is, these things don't have the weight, the pull on you. I really, really, really think it's important to repeat these truths to yourself until it sinks in. It sounds so elementary. But it really makes a difference. This, if we cut you, you need to be bleeding these, okay? It needs to just be a part of who you are, because the subtle lies in your head creep in. God's not abandoning you. He never will. Let's see what highlights I want to hit here. God cares about your suffering, but we're going to talk about that in a minute in more detail. Depression is lying to us. These are still spiritual things. I mean, all these, remembering who God is. Depression lies to us and says that depression means that God hates me. Remember that Jesus passed the love test on the cross. And we talked about that before, but the love test is, if you love me, you'll do X, Y, Z. Well, Jesus proved that on the cross because he died in your place. He didn't just die to set a good example. This is how you martyr. He died in your place. It's the ultimate example of love. So if you're ever wondering whether God loves you, just think of the cross. That kind of ends the discussion there. The next thing, what do we do about depression? Remember who you are and whose you are. This is all about identity. Let me pick a good participant here. You, and you're looking at me. Aha, see? Don't ever catch eyes with the speaker. Then you're in trouble. Okay, what's your name?
Addison.
Who gave you that name?
My parents.
Okay, your parents. All right, so there's one thing about identity that's interesting. The one who made something and the one who owns something gets to name it. So you have a name, Addison. It was given to you by the people who made you. If you don't understand that, you can talk to someone later. But they got to name you because they made you. Now, and if we're talking about my dog, I got to name, when my wife and I got to, she, if she listens to this tape, she'll have to remind me that she named the dog. So my wife and I together sort of named our dog. We didn't make the dog. Again, that's not what we're going to talk about tonight. But we own the dog, and so we got to name it. So if something makes it, whoever makes it gets to name it. Whoever owns it gets to name it. God is both the maker and the owner. So he gets to name you. He's the only one who gets to name you. But the earth, the world is lining up around the building trying to give us a different name. Don't buy it. God, your true identity comes from him alone. One or two things about identity, and again, I'm going to spend most of the evening next week talking about identity, but identity is just your sense of self or your self-worth, okay? And where you place your identity is critical, because if you misplace your identity in things like, you know, we were talking about the little g gods from a few weeks ago, you know, power, money, influence, all the things, relationships. If you put your identity in something like that, that can be lost or taken from you, what do you got then? You ain't got much. It's crucial that you place your identity in something that's never going to change. And the only thing I can think of that's unchanging is God. Okay. Seventh thing, seek professional help. This is what everyone wants to hear, right? We're going to talk about medication in just a second. Okay, this is another thing you can do about depression, seek professional help. Let's talk about therapy and counseling first. Therapy and counseling are sort of the same word. Therapy just means it was from a psychologist. Counseling means it was from someone who has a master's degree. But some of the best treatment providers I've ever met have master's degrees and not doctoral degrees. So don't get caught up in that, and don't get concerned about therapy or counseling. Those are kind of synonymous words. So it's very, very helpful to talk with someone who will listen to your problems, who's not invested in, you know, who's not a family member sometimes. Friends are awesome. Family members are fantastic sounding boards. But every now and then, if your depression is bad, if your anxiety is really bad, it's very helpful to speak with a professional. The thing about a professional is they've heard that 100 times before, probably that week or that month. It's not going to be strange or shocking to them if you tell them that sometimes you've thought about hurting yourself, or that you have been unfaithful in your marriage, or that you're afraid of spiders. They're not going to go, "Oh my gosh," and laugh at you. They've heard that before, and they can probably help you. They have a lot of strategies to overcome problems. That's what we do. All right. And then, you know, one thing that I like to do is I like to help people find the lies on their glasses. You know, a counselor is probably going to be someone who's going to listen to you. If you go to a counselor and they talk the whole time, go find you a different counselor. You want someone who's going to try to understand you first, and then they have maybe a few things that might suggest for you. But if they give you the top three tips to go live a successful life, you might want to go find another counselor. Okay, medication. Most people do not want to take medication. Okay, let's just go ahead and get that out of the way. Of course not. I mean, why would you want to? I mean, if you can not take medication or take medication, you know, which would your choice be? That's not unusual to not want to take medication. But a lot of people think they shouldn't take medication for a spiritual reason. I think a lot of times people think that medication is like the easy button at Staples, you know. You know, that's a cop-out. You know, I should suffer more. I should really fight through this. And in a lot of ways, you know, that's a decent lesson of life to fight through if you can overcome it. But sometimes when you get so depressed that nothing is helping, not even therapy can help you, because you're so depressed that you can't make use of the tools that the therapist is giving you. So please don't think of medication as an easy button. There's still so much work to do when you're dealing with depression and anxiety. But medicine sometimes makes the work easier to do, okay? Believe it or not, medication usually helps, not always, especially if your depression When your depression's real deep, and you know, eating broccoli and jogging a mile just isn't helping you, and listening to a Jeff Foxworthy CD, although I highly recommend that. Sometimes when you're down in one of these deep funks of depression, medicine really helps, and it makes everything more effective. Believe it or not, 76% is the number. That's how effective antidepressant medicine can be. Ooh, that's pretty good. Now, they compared that with, in these tests, they do these things called a placebo. So half the people take a pill that's made of sugar, which probably tastes yummy, and then the other half take a medicine that's the real antidepressant. And so 18% of the people who take a placebo actually get better, okay? That's pretty good. 76% of the people who take the real one actually get better. That's really good. That's strong. That tells us that there's something chemical sometimes going on when someone's depressed. And believe it or not, medicine is as effective as therapy alone. If you compared counseling and therapy, no medicine, and someone who took medicine and no therapy, in some chronic depression states, medicine is as effective or more effective than therapy. Okay, I don't know if that's a shock to you or not, but I keep hitting the point that depression can be extremely medically based. Okay, but there's a couple things to keep in mind. If you start taking medicine, you need to expect about 2 to 6 weeks before the medicine takes effect. Okay, and that's a really long time. And really, to prevent a relapse, once you start taking medicine, if you decide to do that, you really need to put the seatbelt on and wait anywhere from about 4 to 9 months before you, just because you start feeling better after a month or two, you probably don't want to stop. You want to keep that on. You remember when the doctor would give you an antibiotic and they'd say, take this for 10 days, even if you start feeling better, take it all the way through. Why do they say that? Because sometimes you may think the virus or whatever is gone, and you just say, I don't want to take that pill anymore, it's too big. And then it comes back. So if you make the decision to take medicine and you start feeling better, just take it for about 6 months or so, 4 to 9 months, somewhere in that range. You're already taking the medicine. Let's give it the knockout punch. And you remember from the other day, it's really, really important because depression tends to be repetitive, and the older you get, the deeper these get, and the closer together. But if we intervene with counseling and medication, we can stop that cycle. Okay? And that's really, really important. Okay, Scripture does not forbid taking medicine, as far as I can read. Okay? Some of you would love to hear if you have things that I need to know about. But from what I understand, Scripture doesn't forbid it. For me, it takes faith to take medicine. Just like it takes faith to undergo any medical procedure. And remember that all healing is God's healing, okay? And God often works through doctors and medication. But, there's a couple downsides. I mean, you've heard of side effects. Sometimes antidepressant medicine causes side effects. And usually if it's a serious thing, I tell people to stop. But I don't prescribe medicine. I'm a psychologist, so I'm really off the hook. But if you have bad side effects, talk to the doctor that prescribed it, and they can probably suggest another way around it. And you also wouldn't want to take medicine just to avoid a real problem. Because if you have an unresolved issue and you think, I'm just going to take a pill and then it'll all go away. By the way, antidepressants don't save marriages, just so you know. I haven't found one yet that fixes that. If you avoid real problems that caused depression, then the symptoms will return when the medication stops. Okay? Super important. Last thing. The last thing that I would say causes depression or to do about depression is to challenge the lies about suffering with truth about suffering. And I just decided I would put all this on your handout so that you guys would be able to reference this later, because sometimes I tend to talk a little fast. What are the lies about suffering? Okay, well, there's the secular view, which basically means kind of the here and now, the non-biblical view. The secular view of suffering is that suffering has no purpose, and that suffering interrupts my happiness. And if we ask most people, Christians and non-Christians alike, the meaning of life, most people would try to give some answer about happiness. Well, if suffering takes away my happiness, then suffering takes away the meaning of my life. Okay, so so from a secular point of view, suffering must be managed and lessened. The sooner the better. And of course, no one likes to suffer, so if you gave me an option to not suffer, I would probably take it. But our culture spends billions of dollars trying to recognize and identify and eliminate suffering as quickly as possible. But then because suffering can't be completely eliminated, everyone gets this feeling of hopelessness. We already talked about what happens when you get to a place of hopelessness. Because if you think you're just facing suffering for all of eternity, that's a bad thing. Okay, so what's the biblical view? Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but suffering and evil are the enemies of God. I wrote on your handout that God hates suffering. That's true. But suffering is not outside of God's plan. It's usually a part of his plan. Okay? I'll say that again. Suffering is not outside of God's plan. No one woke God up from a nap and said, "You're not going to believe it. Al's suffering." And he goes, "What? What happened?" Suffering is a part of God's plan for everyone in this room's life. You know, I haven't met anyone who hasn't gone through pain and suffering to at least a small extent in their life. God hates it and has gone to great lengths to eliminate it, okay? Which is different than the secular view. Secular view is there's no purpose in it. I didn't say God didn't say there was a purpose in it. I said God hates it. Okay, suffering is normal. Ooh. I know, I'm trying to ruffle some feathers, so that's why I'm not giving out my home address. Suffering is normal. It's a part of life in a broken world. I've heard some people say that if you're alive, you're going to eventually experience pain and suffering, and I do agree with that. Okay, not to the other part yet. Okay, there's a couple of great Bible verses that I love. In Job, chapter 2, verse 10, Job says, "Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" What a great question. Shall we accept only good from God and not trouble? 1 Peter 4:12, this one's even better. "Dear friend, do not be surprised at the painful trial you're suffering, as though something strange were happening to you." Isn't that awesome? As though something strange were happening. I mean, he's almost laughing as he's saying that. So suffering is normal, but we seem so shocked when it comes, don't we? I think it has something to do with those expectations and reality again. Honestly, I mean, I really, even though I know better, I really think that I'm shocked if I don't catch a high percentage of the green lights, you know, or you know, I'm trying to get somewhere and there's a traffic jam, and I'm just so shocked. Or you know, you get sick or something. I mean, goodness. I wouldn't want that for anyone, but we have these unbelievable expectations. Okay, now I am not saying that you should just lower your expectations and become a pessimist. That's not what I'm saying, because then you'll just be sad, and most of the things you're sad about will never happen. But we can expect suffering as normal, but I don't want you to dread it, because we know that God is at work in suffering, okay? Always. All right, suffering always has a purpose, even when we don't understand it. You'll think this is kind of funny. I am a psychologist because I was terrible at calculus-based physics. Okay, I started off as an engineering student in college for no reason. No, didn't even like it. But you know, 2 years in, I ran into a professor who'd been in the United States from Japan for 2 weeks, and not only was he speaking a different language than me, but calculus was a tough language for me too, and I was suffering, and I got out of engineering, you know, so I'm a psychologist today because of suffering. I was not a good enough athlete to be a professional athlete. Okay, now the funny, I love saying it that way because I know all of you are thinking, well, he was probably pretty good then. I have a friend who said he thought about trying out for the Olympics. That makes it, you think to yourself, oh, he must be pretty good at downhill skiing. No, we've all thought about trying out for the, but that doesn't mean I'm good. Okay. My vision is terrible and I lack all the physical tools necessary. I was not a great athlete, but I would have loved to have been. But part of the reason I'm a psychologist is because I was not a great athlete. That option did not open up for me. Okay, suffering led me to something I love. I love being a psychologist. I probably wouldn't have loved being an athlete. Who knows? Money. Who likes money and power? I mean, come on. Anyway, remember that God always gives us what we would have asked for if we knew everything he knows. We said that before. I'm going to say it one more time. It's one of my favorite quotes. God always gives us what we would have asked for if we knew everything he knows. So I would have asked for terrible vision so that I couldn't hit a curveball if I knew everything God knows, that I could be here today wearing corrective lenses here and reading glasses. I would have been praying that God make that happen if I knew everything God knows. I actually agree with that. So just because suffering doesn't make sense to us doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense to God, okay? God may have excellent reasons for allowing the problems that are going on in your life and the difficulties and suffering that you don't understand. Have you ever heard of the butterfly effect? That the butterfly flapping his wings causes the wind to blow a little more and the leaves rustle and then the branches move and then eventually it turns into a big hurricane way across the world. I don't think that's actually true. But the butterfly effect is the name for we don't understand how this thing happening today will have repercussions down the road. There have been a lot of interesting movies about that sort of theory. But just remember, God is not vindictive or cruel. God is not like Zeus from Roman mythology. And if you make... You know, if you make Zeus mad, you need to duck and run for cover. God's not looking for an opportunity to nail you. He nailed himself on the cross for you. Okay, that's different. He's not vindictive and cruel. I'm having trouble with that word. Vindictive. Okay, another thing about suffering. Suffering can be correction or punishment. It can be. Think about the examples in the Bible of Jonah. He went through suffering because he was making a bad choice and God brought him back around. Or the children of Israel, how many times they go through suffering because of their own disobedience? Greedy people tend to lose relationships. That's suffering as a consequence or a punishment. Or a lack of discipline leads to hunger. Okay? Hunger is suffering. Sometimes God uses suffering as a correction to get your attention. So I don't want to say that suffering is always like super fun, but there are times where it's corrective and punishing to get you to redirect. Another thing about suffering. Suffering brings us to the end of ourselves and draws us to Christ. Believe it or not, I found Christ because of suffering. Suffering woke me up to the realization that I was a sinner and doomed. I needed saving from myself. And it took a lot of suffering for me to realize that. I needed someone to pay my debt. And no one else around me was debt-free other than Jesus. So Jesus had plenty of credit. So he was able to transfer his credit to my account. Thank goodness. But if I had not suffered, I would have never known I needed a Savior. So I'm going to be with the Lord for all eternity because suffering woke me up. And I'll take that deal. Thank goodness for suffering. Suffering is producing something great in us, like eating your vegetables. Here we go. James 1, verse 2. Oh, wait. Man, I almost missed my opportunity to do the thing. I've been wanting to push that button. Okay. All right, I got a really weird drawing up here. Y'all all, you probably know the passage I'm referring to, James 1, verse 2. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Okay, I always thought this verse was kind of funny. Why am I supposed to be joyful about trials and suffering? I got a little stick man drawn out here, and some of you may not be able to see that. He's got a frowny face. Because, I mean, honestly, who's really happy about trials and suffering? If this was the end of it, then, you know, what's James talking about? Well, I got a little stair step here. Yeah, you got trials and suffering, and then he says that leads, these are tests of your faith, and then you got perseverance that comes from that. And then at the top of the stairs, you got maturity, completeness, lacking nothing. Okay, my little guy right here, you can't see, that's a dotted line. He can't see over this step. That's all he sees. It's trials and suffering, you know, pointless, endless. But this is God up here in the helicopter. That's supposed to be a helicopter. I was trying to think, should I draw him on a throne or the crown? I just thought, helicopter, you know? Anyway, God's up here in the helicopter. He's smiling. If this guy would just look up, he could see what God is doing, okay? Now, who would be happy about maturity and completeness lacking nothing? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So I'm pretty joyful here. I'm not too joyful here. But if I know that this is taking me up the staircase, then I can be joyful here, okay? And I think this is what James is talking about. It's a matter of what is my perspective, what is my theology of trials and suffering? Do I think that it's the end of the game and that that's just the way it's going to be for me? Or do I think that God is up to something? Yeah, I promise you God is up to something. Maturity, completeness, lacking nothing. Another thing, suffering is redemptive. It's like a furnace. You know, you put gold and silver in a furnace and it boils off the impurities. Suffering is like that. It's like a big old furnace. And it reveals and destroys your false gods. Another thing suffering does, it strengthens you and changes you. I am more patient, less selfish, probably more generous and more humble today because of the cost of impatience and selfishness and greed and pride in my past. You probably would like me more today than you would have liked me years ago because of the impurities. And I mean, I still got a long way to go, ask my wife. But man, I am less greedy and prideful than I used to be. How in the world? Well, because God boiled some of those impurities off of me and still is boiling them off through things like suffering. Philippians 1:6, I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will be faithful to complete it in Christ Jesus. Okay, the greatest thing of all, I saved it for last, the greatest thing of all that suffering does, it turns me into a free lover of God. What in the world does that mean? All I'm saying is loving God for who he is and not for what he provides. The stories of Job or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, in heaven, what do you get? You get God. If you go in there just to get gold, then you're going to miss the boat. God is worthy of our worship and love. And to love God because he has done great things for you would be no different than marrying God for his money. Okay, don't do that. God is worthy of it. And so suffering boils off my impure motives and helps me be a free lover of God. All right, almost done here. Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. There's a guy named Jonathan Edwards who wrote a sermon at 18 years of age entitled Christian Happiness, and he had 3 points. He said, the bad things in life... This verse in Romans, he says, this verse means that the bad things in my life will turn out for my good. The good things can't be ever taken away from me, and the best is yet to come. Interesting. The bad things in my life will turn out for my good. The good things can't be taken away from me, and the best is yet to come. So what are the good things? Well, things like adoption into God's family, a justification, union with Him, relational peace with God now. What are some of the best things that he's referring to? Well, life in heaven, life in a new redeemed earth, resurrection, a clear relationship with God, and eternal peace and joy. As a Christian, when bad things, when trials and suffering start to come, we know what's happening. Like Peter's saying, let's don't be shocked. Whatever it takes to bring you to Jesus is worth the pain. So don't be a fool who tries to gain everything in this life so that you lose everything in eternity. Okay, in conclusion, it's a fallen world. You know, we're broken people. Depression is an unfortunate but real illness, okay, that's part of that brokenness. If you're depressed, keep fighting. Be working on some of the things that we've been talking about. Keep your focus on the goal of completeness and wholeness, okay? Most importantly, God will never abandon you. In your weakness, He is strong. Your future is certain with God, and there is a purpose to your pain. And God will bring all pain and suffering to an ultimate end. Let me pray real quick, and then we'll do some questions and stuff. Dear God, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk and to these people and to talk about depression and suffering. Lord, you are in our suffering. You're refining us. It has a purpose. Thank you for this time. In Jesus' name, amen.